And this morning is the very end of this 10-day retreat that I've been teaching up at Jokoji for 14 people. And I'm very much filled with the retreat. I'll leave here as soon as we finish and go up there for the closing at 11:30 or so for the retreat. And it's very special to be on retreat in general, but this retreat is particularly sweet for me. People who are very dedicated practitioners are all there. All the people there are very dedicated, a lot of experience. And I get the opportunity in this retreat to work with them very closely. And there were 14 people, and I can see 14 people a day for interviews. So I saw everyone every day and kept track, and it was quite wonderful. And what I'd like to do this morning is to try to do a summary of what I've been teaching for the week, the 10 days. And I don't know if I can do it, but that's what I'd like to try. Ironically, the subject is simplicity, so I should be able to say that quickly. One way of describing spiritual practice is that it's a homecoming, it's a coming home. And it's useful to, I think, distinguish a little bit between a house and a home. And a house is just, a building. And many people can see, you can walk, drive down the street and see lots of houses. But a home is a place where someone inhabits and they feel at home in. They feel like this is a place they can relax and be themselves and don't have to defend themselves and don't have to create the self-image. Or it's a place of acceptance, usually, a place where if there's family members, that there's some kind of acceptance. Family members sometimes have complicated relationships, but it's a place where people can kind of let their hair down or feel at home. And at least in the image of it, the kind of the generic image of being at home is quite different than being in a house. And I think spiritual practice is in part about coming home, finding how to be at home, not just in your home, but wherever you go, in yourself, in life. And in being kind of a homecoming, it's also a kind of coming back to something we already know. I believe, it's a kind of belief, that we all have some deep innate knowing of what is true. And or what it's like to be at home, or what it's like to be just present in a very simple, complete way, without needing to be anything at all for anybody. And that part of what spiritual practice is to point to that which we most deeply know, and to perhaps find an opportunity to develop that or live in that much more often. And that is not a matter of imparting teachings or something you don't know. But the practice is really about pointing to something you already deeply know yourself. Maybe you just have hints of it. Maybe it's something you remember, maybe a childhood experience or some experience you've had at some point in your life felt so right or so true or so much at home that it becomes a cornerstone or a touchstone, the memory for what's possible. And maybe perhaps spiritual practice is about coming to that again. And it's not about creating it, which is many people think, it's something you have to create. If I put all the conditions just right, then I'll have it again. But the kind of deep knowing that's within us is really can't be created. You can't create conditions to make it happen. It's there. And the very act of creating something gets in the way of it. It's a state of great simplicity. T.S. Eliot wrote the poem The Four Quartets, and in it there's a line that goes something like, a state of complete simplicity costing nothing less than everything. And Buddhist spirituality can be understood as a process of simplification or a process of pointing to simplicity. The process of liberation, the process of coming home. It And it's pointing to something very, very simple that's always here. The present moment, in and of itself, is always quite simple. If we live fully in the present moment with no before and after, no here or there, it's quite simple. If we bring in past and future, here and there, then it gets complicated very quickly. But the present moment in and of itself is quite simple. And the present moment in and of itself is indistinguishable from our capacity to know it, from knowing. And there's something about knowing itself which is quite simple. And if you knew how simple it was, and knew how precious that simplicity is, then you would be free. One of the comments that several people made at the retreat, these are people who have done practice for a long time, was they said, by the end we finished this theme of simplicity, they said, why had no one ever told me it was so simple? Mindfulness is really simple. It's not about, they thought it had to do about finding, getting some insights, and kind of, they try to, you know, use a laser-like mindfulness to kind of get in there and see clearly, kind of understand what's really going on, and or some particular states of mind was the point, or to get rid of certain things which were undesirable was the point. Our capacity to know is so simple, mindfulness is so simple, it doesn't require any of that. And to understand, taste the simplicity of what the practice is about is transformative. And so I tried during this week to try to point to that simplicity. Can you hear me okay, everyone? And one of the things I said is that the homecoming, coming home, is not always a comfortable process. Just as maybe in our physical homes, there could be places, rooms we haven't cleaned for a long time. Or maybe we haven't been to the basement and the attic, and finally we go to it and we find, you know, musty, dusty, unfinished projects and or things that we try to push away and shove away and not pay attention to. So part of coming home also entails going into all the rooms in our houses, in our homes, and cleaning them up and seeing what's actually there. And part of that is seeing the ways in which we complicate the simplicity of presence, simplicity of knowing. And seeing the different elements of the complication allows the possibility of simplifying our presence, our knowing. Seeing what keeps us from being free helps us then to let go of those or to find a simplicity that maybe doesn't even require letting go of them, but the simplicity that's beyond them, the simplicity that the larger simplicity of knowing that holds them. There are two movements in Buddhist practice, speaking very generally. One is to see what obstructs your freedom and then find ways to let go of it. The other way is to see what obstructs your freedom and then find how there's a larger freedom that can hold that. It's kind of like the knowing of that which obstructs your freedom can lead to two things. One is, with that information, you can try to do something about your problem. The other thing you can do is to relax and hold that problem in the larger piece of awareness itself. And both are very important ways, these two pointings. And some people can only do the first until they get a clear enough sense of what awareness is, how precious and phenomenally simple and transformative awareness is, so that they can trust awareness enough so they can do the second option. And so they can see a problem they have in their life, no matter what the problem is, and rather than thinking they have to get rid of it or fix anything, of course you should do that to some degree, but in your heart of hearts you don't have to do that. Rather, you have to discover how to hold that in the non-reactive, open, spacious, boundless awareness that's free. The simple awareness which is always here can hold everything and not be caught by things, not contracted around what goes on. And that entails a trusting of awareness. And the profundity of what Buddhism has to offer involves a phenomenal trusting of your awareness, of awareness. We trust that before we trust anything else. And if you look at your life, what you'll find is you trust many different things. We don't use that language so much, but you trust your bank account. You trust having money in the bank account. You trust building up a sense of self. You trust your fear. You trust your ambition. You trust your desires. You trust your aversions. We trust them because we're so quick to take up residence in those. We're so quick to live in those. We're so quick to have them be the preoccupation of our mind. Anything which is a preoccupation of the mind is something, in a way, that entails some kind of trust. And what we're asked to do in Buddhism is to trust awareness instead. And that can feel very vulnerable and very tenuous, because where is awareness? What is awareness? It has no color, no shape, no sound. Awareness is very silent. Awareness by itself is kind of like space. It's often likened to space. You look around in space, you can't see space exactly except by what defines it. It's empty of things. And if we're always focusing on things, we're not going to appreciate the space. Awareness is always focusing on things and preoccupations, that it's very hard then to turn away from all the preoccupations we have, what we feel in need, and rest in awareness itself. So there's two ways, either of letting go of what obstructs your freedom, or understanding how there's a freedom available right now when your awareness can hold that in a non-reactive way. So there's a list I went through during the retreat of 9 different aspects of simplicity. Simplicity of being home, of knowing, of awareness. And for some people, just pointing to the nature of awareness itself. And for other people, it defines what they have to let go of to discover that simplicity, depending on which of these two approaches you take. The first, and the list is progressively, is understood to be progressively more difficult things to let go of, more deeply embedded in our psyche. Though it's a little bit humbling to realize this, because the first one by itself seems quite daunting. The first is not to believe in taking things personally. So what do you think of that? Are you ready for that one? Not to believe in taking things personally. Not to believe that there are things which will define you. Taking things personally means that these are things that define who you are. In Nepali, it's called Sakkaya Ditti. And we're very quick to take things to define who we are. Our body, our intellect, our emotions, our possessions, our relationships with people around us, the cosmos. Some people identify with nature, with the world. I'm one with the world. There's all kinds of ways in which we can want to define ourselves. And the more kind of closer ones can cause a lot of suffering. And a lot of our suffering has to do on this personalizing things, taking things personally. And it's very liberating to realize you don't have to do that. In small ways, people begin seeing that as they practice, and in big ways. I mean, for example, people can struggle for a long time with physical pain. And then at some point, they feel the pain, and they realize, you see a difference between taking it personally, my pain, and just holding it there kind of openly as the pain. There's a whole constellation of reactions that come together with my pain that are absent with just the pain. Self-pity, for example, to mention just one. And just to allow something to be there, not take it personally. Or to have a strong emotional reaction and not take the emotional reaction personally. To recognize it's there, be very honest about it being there, but not take it personally means you don't take ownership of it so that you don't engage with it and act on it and defend yourself from it or fight it or support it or fuel it or all kinds of ways in which we take things personally. And just allow the emotion to be there freely. It'll fade away by itself. But if we engage in it, if we take it personally, often we just feed it and fuel it. It's not like it's happening to someone else. But to take it personally is to say that this defines who I am. And any definition that we have about who we are limits who we are. And we can see that in other people, how quickly they limit themselves by their definition. They'll come to you and say, I'm incapable of doing that by myself. That's a definition. They're finding themselves. And sometimes you see it's not accurate. I'm unworthy, or, I'm always this way, these people say. Or sometimes people define you. And it's very clear when they're doing that, then it's, once upon a distant time, you just happen to get a little bit annoyed, slightly. And for that person, you're always someone who's an angry person. The person's always kind of careful around you. And they've kind of put you in a box, in a category. There's many ways in which you can feel how people define you. It's a lot harder to see how we define ourselves by taking things personally. It's a lot simpler. Life is a lot simpler if you don't take things as a definition of who you are. You can take kind of a working kind of, you can have kind of general light ideas, to carry around with you. If someone asks you what nationality you are, it's okay to tell them. But, you're not fooled by that. You're not going to let that be the kind of the thing that defines you. If they want, they want a category to put you in, that's fine. It's helpful a little bit for the census or whatever. But this is the first step of simplification, is to learn how to simplify ourselves from taking things personally. The second, and this is a popular one, especially for people who, you'll see here. And the second one is giving up clinging to virtue and spiritual practices. Thank God, finally. I've been doing this Buddhist practice for 10 years now, and finally I can let go of it. It doesn't mean stop doing. It doesn't mean stop being devoted to a virtuous life or being engaged in spiritual practices, but no longer clinging to it. And this is really common for people engaged in spiritual life, is to cling, religious life, is to cling to their religion, cling to their spirituality. In part, spirituality will often, people use it as a way of defining themselves. And so they go around, they do all these kinds of, they adopt a garb, a uniform, a way of talking, or, world views. Not so much because it's true, but because it's a proof that they belong to that tradition. They're part of that. This is who their identity is. When I first showed up at the San Francisco Zen Center in the 70s, you could tell who were the real Zen students. They were the ones who wore gray Amish vests, fat pants, and carried Danish school bags, and wore malas, these Buddhist beads. I mean, all those things in themselves are wonderful things. But it was adopted as a uniform, and all these people were going around with various combinations of those things. They feel some comfort that they knew that they were on the right path if they were at least wearing the right clothes. We cling to religious practices. That practice will do it for me. Mindfulness, I've heard that's really great. And there's hope, and so we cling with our hope, with our desire, with our ambition. If I really do it well, I'll be the most mindful person on my block. And people will just praise me to no end. To cling to virtue, be self-righteous, for example, is a process of complicating our life unnecessarily. So in Buddhism, these things are important, but you don't want them to. You want to, in a sense, let go of them. The freedom is not complicated by virtue. It's not freedom. The process of becoming free is to let go of clinging to virtue. So hopefully you're virtuous at the same time. The third is giving up doubt. And doubt is kind of an obvious way in which we complicate our mind, complicate ourselves. And, often it's difficult to feel at home if you're filled with doubt. And doubt in particular about what is the nature of freedom. what's the nature of to, you know, what it really feels like to be at home, what it is to be really to know deeply. And if you don't really know for yourself what freedom is, even when you engage in spiritual practice, you're always going to have a little bit of doubt, which is going to agitate the mind, keep you from really being at peace. And it's just the way it is. It's okay. But the process of simplification is to then, at some point, let go of doubt also. Hesitation, holding back. The fourth is no longer clinging to sensual pleasure. And this is, you find a lot of lists in Buddhism that focus on sensual pleasure. And you think of Buddhists are party poopers. But the thing is that sensual pleasure in and of itself is fine. You're welcome to enjoy it. But it's the clinging to it which is the problem. And sensual pleasure is a shorthand for the tremendous drive in human beings to towards pleasure and to avoid to comfort and pleasure. And on a gross level, we see that you know that some people confuse pleasure with happiness, and people will pursue all kinds of pleasant activities, thinking that's going to provide them with their happiness. Addicts and alcoholics, sometimes you know, it's a clear example of this. But there's a lot of attitudes and beliefs we have around pleasure. It's not just simply attachment to pleasure in a physical way. But it also comes with our attachments to beliefs about what pleasure entails or discomfort entails. Some people feel that, they have this attitude that their life is only successful, they've only, doing it right, life right, if things are pleasant, if there's pleasure. If something's, if they have a headache or they're a little bit off that day or things are uncomfortable or there's no electricity or no water that day or something, I don't know what. So there are various things which are uncomfortable. That by definition means that something's off with life, something's off with me, I've blown it, life has blown it, and something has to be fixed. Freedom has to allow the possibility of not reacting for or against pleasure and comfort. Comfort and pleasure is not of freedom. And if you are pursuing and preoccupied with pleasure, you're not going to discover the radical simplicity of just now, just being present. And but pleasure drives human beings to a phenomenal degree. Many times I believe people's philosophy of life or even political position, political party they adhere to, sometimes is not because of the great philosophy that's involved, but sometimes it's just it arises out of a reaction to pleasure or displeasure. Someone's uncomfortable with seeing a homeless person, and their whole philosophy of how to deal politically with homeless people is not out of some wise philosophies, because they're repelled by their own discomfort. And they're trying to get rid of that and push that away. The amoeba-like reaction to pleasure and displeasure is very foundational to what drives human beings. The fourth complication is aversion, ill will. And it's a little bit kind of the flip side of sensual desire, clinging to sensual desire, but the clinging to ill will, to aversion. There's a lot of energy, a lot of seductive power in ill will and aversion, in part because people use it sometimes to define themselves, but sometimes because of the rush that comes with it. Sometimes because the belief systems entailed what you feel again, like you need and don't need, what you need to be present for and not present for, and if there's something there which is uncomfortable, we have this ill will and we want to push things away. The mind cannot be simple. The mind cannot discover the simplicity of freedom that's present right now, that's available right now, the home that's here, regardless of what's happening, if the mind is for or against anything. The awareness, at least. The awareness cannot be contracted towards or away from anything. The sixth, and for those of you who are following the traditional list, I'm going over 9, usually there's 10, and 6 and 7 are going to be collapsed into 6. And 6 is clinging to spiritual experiences. Now this is considered really hard to get rid of. You know, it's a lot easier to get rid of, to let go of taking things personally than it is to cling to spiritual experiences. Certainly you can cling to it because of, you know, taking it personally. But there's, you know, even without that clinging, of taking things personally, cling to spiritual experiences a way of complicating, agitating the mind, hindering the freedom that's possible. And so many people who engage in spiritual, everyone who engages in spiritual practice will do this sooner or later. There's levels of calm and peace and well-being that you've heard about, and so you want to get it. Only if I get those things will I, you know, then I'll be okay. Or you've had a taste of it, and I got to have that again. And so you spend years negotiating your mind and everything else around you in order to re-experience that particular peace that you had, that particular joy or love or great bliss or whatever it was. And to cling to any spiritual experience creates suffering and is a way of complicating the simplicity of just being, being present. The seventh complication is conceit. And conceit involves, at the very foundation of conceit, is not taking things personally, not saying that something defines who I am, but rather is the very sense that I am, which can seem very innocent or so obvious, or so what's the problem with that? Of course I am. I mean, I'm not someone else. But there's something about, and we're talking about very subtle states now. In very subtle states, when the mind is very attentive, you'll see that the very sense of I am is extra. It's not needed. It's a fabrication. It's an assumption that arises in part out of the sum total workings of who you are. The sense of I am is, you know, if you look at it, is very amorphous. It's very, you know, it's very difficult to understand or see it directly for what it is, beyond kind of a vague sense. Some people might say it's a sum total of all our clinging. You know, how it all feels together. I don't know if this is a good analogy for this, but I use it sometimes as if some great athlete like Michael Jordan is, you know, playing a championship game, and it's the Chicago Bulls are, you know, 1 point behind, and it's 1 minute left in the game or 10 seconds left in the game, and he has the ball, and, you know, he's driving towards the basket, and, you know, the whole championship, you know, hinges on him making that basket. And in the middle of that, he starts wondering, am I? How am I? Where is the true self here? This is who I really am. He's not going to make the basket. He's going to trip over his feet, probably. To have that kind of self-conscious concern about I am at that moment, it just gets in the way. It's kind of like I am. It's kind of like, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but sometimes used, your eyes. Your eyes function, I suppose. You can see with your eyes, but you can't see your eyes. And then to get involved with the sense that I have eyes, this is where my eyes are, this is how they feel like, is to actually take one step apart, away from the seeing that eyes do. Does that make sense? Let your eyes just see. You don't have to be concerned about the eye-ness of the eye. It makes things a little bit more complicated. The sense of I am makes things more complicated. One of the things it lends itself to is one of the more traditional definitions of conceit is comparative thinking. We compare ourselves to others. We compare ourselves to how we were in the past, how we want to be in the future. And it's one of the great sources of suffering is comparing ourselves. It's possible to live in the world as we are without needing any comparisons. Comparisons are valid in some ways, but we suffer so much by getting contracted and defining ourselves and getting a sense of I am from that, those comparisons. It's not needed. So to let go, to drop even the sense of I am, to have the kind of radical trust and awareness that it's possible just to be present with your awareness, with knowing, with life, with beingness, in the same way that you let your eyes just see without getting tied up with what's the I-ness of the eyes. So then we're at the eighth. The eighth is... So now we're getting really subtle, according to the list, that gets progressively more subtle, closer and closer towards complete freedom, is restlessness. It's kind of amazing that there's still restlessness after, you know, you're no longer defining yourself and no longer clinging. But restlessness, agitation, has a whole wide range of what, you know, restlessness can mean in us. I mean, sometimes we can barely sit on our cushion. It's like, you come down to sit for meditation, it's like being at the rodeo. And it's a successful meditation, the fact that you manage to get to the end of your sitting without bolting. But I think what they're talking about here is a very subtle restlessness of the mind that focuses on objects, the mind that focuses on something external to itself. Or to say it a little bit differently, perhaps, the mind preoccupied in objects, the mind which is delimited by what it's paying attention to. If I have a desire, you can be driven by the desire, the thing you want, and you're always looking at the thing you want. But part of the movement of practice is to turn the awareness away from the thing you want and sense and feel the desire itself. If you have aversion, turn away from the thing that you have aversion about and turn around and just feel what it's like to have aversion in and of itself, the subjective experience of that. When the mind is always focused on a thing, the mind is actually alienated from itself. When the mind is restless, there's a way in which restlessness sometimes is self-perpetuating, like desire sometimes is self-perpetuating. Anything you do regularly and continuously, you create a certain momentum in the mind. So if you're always busy, always doing multitasking and doing many different things, it's very hard to stop because the momentum to want to do is still there. If you're always, the mind is always preoccupied with things, then the momentum is there for the mind to kind of a little bit be agitated, to always want more things to fill it. It's kind of like you've come into a room like here, and you're always focusing on the things of the room. You think that's all that's really important. And so you look at things and things and things and things. And finally, you realize, wait a minute, there's something else here. There's a space in the room. Wow. The space holds it all. And that space kind of holds all the things, all the containers. In the same way, awareness that's not preoccupied and focused on the things that it's aware of is kind of like space that holds it all. And as long as its awareness is focusing on things, it's always going to be a little bit agitated, restless. It's always going to be a little bit fragile, brittle. For the mind to be totally soft, pliable, open, spacious, boundless, there has to be a sense of objectless awareness, awareness which has no center. If there's no sense of I am, then there's no center to the awareness. If there's no sense of being focused on an object, there's no there, there's no here, there's no before and after, there's no becoming, there's no movement. Awareness becomes, it's a definition, or all surrounding, all, it's like 360 degrees, it's like all radiant in all directions. So the last of the complications is ignorance. And when the last remnants of ignorance are let go of, then we have the experience of this unconditioned simplicity. And the unconditioned simplicity is ignorance is maybe not the best translation for avidya here, but rather it's unawareness. And when awareness becomes total, when awareness is set free, when the awareness becomes completely simple, when our sense of presence becomes simple and is not focused or preoccupied or caught by anything, when it's 360 degrees all around, then that's the taste of complete, unconditioned simplicity, of being at home. And then, once you have that experience, even just once, very radically, then you realize that it's actually of our nature all the time. That simplicity of awareness, of presence, is actually here all the time. And then, rather than having to get rid of all these things, it's possible then to open your sense of presence or awareness beyond where you're clinging. So you don't have to let go of the clinging, you don't have to let go of the complication. You can just rest and hold it in a bigger container of presence of awareness. So that you don't have to be involved in the incessant movements of becoming and creating and manufacturing things and manipulating the mind. You let the mind get bigger, more open, more space to hold it all. We're kind of like people who... someone who lives in the ocean, and they're always swimming in the ocean, and they really want to rest. So they're swimming, thinking, well, only if they find some island somewhere, well, they can finally pull themselves up on some shore on the dry land and rest. And so they're constantly swimming, and they see these mirages, and they see these different things out in the distance. They're swimming to it, and they come to it, and they really think it's going to work, and they finally get to it, and it turns out that it's nothing there to really support them, and so they got to go swimming some more, and they swim some more in another direction, and they're constantly swimming and looking and trying to find a place to rest, only eventually to finally realize that all they had to do was float, and the water would have held them up just nicely. Awareness is like an ocean that's there, but waiting to hold us, to let us float. A very important aspect, a core aspect of Buddhist practice, is to learn to trust awareness, to place our trust in awareness. And to trust, in doing that, the native intelligence, the innate intelligence of who we are, that bubbles through that. So you don't have to prepare ahead of time when you come to do something, perhaps. You don't have to think ahead or manipulate or create a certain self. You can just show up. It's simple. You don't have to always know. And you also don't have to not know. The radical simplicity of being doesn't entail having possessions, and doesn't entail having no possessions. It doesn't entail having attainments, and it doesn't entail having no attainments. It's realizing the fundamental emptiness of all things. And in seeing the emptiness of all things, trusting your awareness. Letting awareness be the foundation where you float, and let the innate intelligence and compassion and love that's in your home come pouring through. Trusting awareness is to trust, is to give space for intelligence, for love, simplicity. There is no love apart from simplicity. There is no love apart from silence. To trust awareness is to sense the silence and the space which is always here. So it was quite profound for me to be on retreat, and I hope for the people who are there at the retreat, and I hope that you appreciated that whatever sense of the retreat I brought with me in giving this talk, because I feel very much still in it. And I thank you very much.